meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedure Subteam Track 1, Overall Process Support Outreach Issue, taking place on the 14th of February, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room only. If you're only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for a recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Sarah Bakke. Please begin.
Great. Thank you. This is Sarah Bakke, for the record. So thank you, everyone, for joining us this early morning or afternoon or evening, whatever it may be for you. So today we are going to be getting an update from Jeff regarding the accreditation program, and then we're going to be doing some recapping on application and variable fees, as well as application queuing, and touching a little bit on systems and communications before jumping into a new topic, being the applicant guidebook. And then if we have time, hopefully touch on some of our CC2 questions and any other business. But that's what we have on tap today. Before we get into this, if you have an update to your SOI, please let it be known by raising your hand. Okay, seeing nothing, I will assume everyone is up to date. So let's see, next slide. This is just an overview of our schedule of topics so far, highlighting what we will be discussing today. And so on to the accreditation, and at this point I'm going to pass it over to Jeff to give us an update on the happenings with the accreditation program.
Okay, thanks. This is Jeff Newman. Thanks, Sarah. What I'll do is I'll give an update and then my process of where I think it's going. So when we initially discussed the accreditation program, or just RFP program, I think we'll say for short, because of the issues some people have with term accreditation, we had discussed that there would likely be a number of similarities between the process that ICANN was using and still developing to transition from one RFP to another. So if a registry operator, let's say, was using one registry service provider like VeriSign or Neustar, or, you know, there's 20 others, and wanted to switch to another one, there is a process, or there's a requirement under the current registry operator agreement that says that because that's a material subcontract, it needs ICANN approval. So ICANN had instituted a pretty lengthy sort of bureaucratic process on how to make sure that the new registry service provider, the RSP, could go through that approval process. And we recognized the time that we were discussing it, meaning we, the PDP working group and WorkTrack, that there are going to be a lot of similarities between approving an RSP for a transition to approving an RSP or pre-approving an RSP before a TLD process. Because of that similarity, we, as a working group, decided that we would offer a bunch of deference to the ICANN personnel or staff that were undergoing to launch a process, discuss the transition process with the community. So at the beginning of January, there was a call from ICANN. This was discussed in Hyderabad. There were a number of people at that meeting where Francisco led the meeting discussing potential setting up this group. In early January, ICANN issued a call out for volunteers for this group. And I believe that call for volunteers went through the end of January. During this time period, registry stakeholder group reached out to ICANN and said, look, we are not sure that we want to mix the issues of transitioning from one registry to another for existing registry operators with a number of the policy questions that would arise if you set up an RSP program. So ETLD registries asked GDD staff if the registries could deal with the issue of transitions prior to discussing any topics within an RSP pre-approval program. So because of that, and because it doesn't look like this group will address the policy issues with the pre-approval RSP program, I think it's wise for us to take those policy questions that would arise if we were to work on an RSP program and take that back into this work track. So what I've done, you'll notice in the when we get to the CC2 questions, it took a number of areas that we initially thought the ICANN group was going to work on that they may not be working on at this point or would not get to for a long period of time. So I'm not sure what the status is of that ICANN group that was being set up to talk about the transition process from one RSP to another, whether that's just going to involve ETLD registries and RSPs, or whether that would involve, or additionally, would it involve others from the community. I don't have an answer for that. That's probably something that would have to be addressed from CSIRIX and GDD staff. But I do know that we being the work track and overall working group, to take back some of these issues within our work track and working group, so that we can make sure that we're getting community feedback and that we could address it to make sure that this wouldn't delay our timeline. I hope that makes sense. If anyone's got any questions, please let me know. But I think we'll get to some of the areas within the CCTU questions that I've added to the Google spreadsheet, which are not currently on this slide. And I apologize to Sarah and Krista for not having it done before today. So that's why it's not showing up on this slide, but it does show up in the Google Doc when we get to number 5 on the agenda. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. This is Sarah Bakke again for the record. That was very helpful. Does anyone, before we move forward from here, have any questions or concerns or comments that they would like to raise? Okay, I'm not seeing any hands. We'll go on to the next topic then, and we can further discuss this during the CC2 questions if necessary. I see Jeff is typing. I'll just give him 1 second. Okay, so going on to next slide. During our last call, we had wanted to take sort of a consensus vote during the call to to get an idea if there was support for an invoicing system. As shown on the slide here, it was determined during our discussions for the application in variable fees that a lack of invoices was a challenge. And therefore, the working group felt that the system should be capable of sending automatic notices to organizations who require an invoice to pay any fees related to their application. We'd like to get just a feel for the group today. I know there aren't many of us on this call, but to see if you have support for this idea of implementing an invoicing system. So if you could, if you agree with this idea of having an invoicing system, if you could do a little green check mark to indicate your support, that would be wonderful. And if you don't think this is a good idea, please go ahead and do a red X as well.
We have a few people who are only available via telephone.
Okay. If they could indicate, maybe in the, they couldn't do it in the chat. If they want to give a verbal vote, maybe, if they are so inclined. Is there anyone on the line? Can you tell staff that would like to speak?
Hi, and this is Terry, and actually all parties are connected through the Adobe Connect. There's nobody on telephone only at this time.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so I'm seeing 8 red or green checks so far. So it seems that we have a good amount of support, and I see Alan has made a comment saying if some people need invoices, what would be the reason for not doing it? Rubens has commented, Alan, tax regulations in some countries are more bizarre than the old English colonies' habitats can think of. And Michael Fleming also noted the issue is that the invoices are not sent timely, have a lot of mistakes, and some invoices don't even make it, I guess, to the recipients. So thank you all for indicating your support for the invoicing system. And I see that we also have a topic here regarding the cost recovery. Krista, did you want to address this portion of the slide?
Sure. It's Krista for the record. From the last call, there was some conversations on what would happen if the fees going forward had a cost base that was way too low, and how would we make up the difference between being a not-for-profit or ICAM being not-for-profit, and also making sure that that floor isn't too low. So just as an idea, open up for some discussion is whether there's anything that we could do to justify or any ideas or proposals that we could consider on how to address the gap between the application fee and the cost. So, for instance, if we're saying the minimum application fee, and I'm just pulling numbers out of thin air here, are $100,000 and the actual costs are $50,000, just out of thin air, how are we going to use that other $50,000 between the two amounts. Sorry, I shouldn't have used another number than $50,000. But hopefully you get the idea there. So if there is some consensus or people kind of agree with that idea, maybe to put forward another working group or some other method there that can address those questions and or any ideas that might support that. So that's just kind of the idea behind it.
And I see Jeff has his hand up. Jeff, do you have a comment? Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. And I was thinking of possibly or potentially rewording what the question was in a way, and not to put John and Donna on the spot, but I know on previous calls they expressed the view that even if the costs turned out to be much lower, there still should be some floor which may be higher than those costs because make sure that applicants are serious about applying and that we doubt some of the, I don't know how to word it, but I don't want to say less serious applications, but certainly it was the view that if you're going to run and manage a TLD, then you should be willing to put in a certain amount in order to show that you are a serious candidate for the TLD. Donna and John, I'm not sure I necessarily said that correctly. You might say it better, but I just want that to be out there as well. And then the second part would be what you said is, okay, well, what if ICANN does have a surplus because it charges this floor, which is higher than what the costs would be? Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Michael, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Sarah. So I honestly agree with Jeff in the fact that I think that we need to have the, we need to make sure that it's not too low, of course, but I think the cost recovery is a very necessary aspect to keep in mind. But at the same time, I'm wondering if we couldn't change that cost recovery aspect to maybe returning maybe a deposit, for example. If nothing happens and you don't sue ICANN or anything like that for in your first year, you can go ahead and get your, that'll go for you towards your first year of registry management or something like that. I don't know, just an idea, of course, but something like that, I think, would probably help in maybe a proposal. Maybe Donna has a few points.
Okay. Great, thank you, Michael. Good suggestion. And I also see that Rubens has made a comment in the chat saying we could offset the fixed fees of all registries that come out of a procedure. If 1 million was raised, 900,000, 100,000 divided by 1,000 applicants, $100 discount for everyone. And then Donna has said, I think my point was that the application fee needs to take into account that the applicant is acquiring a unique piece of internet real estate. In this context, I don't think it's unreasonable to have the floor set at $185,000. I see Michael is typing. He says, but the problem comes back to two points. One, cost recovery is too high. And two, what do you do with the extra? And Michael, I see your hand is still up. Is that a new hand or an old hand? It's an old hand. Okay, great. Thank you. Jeff, your hand is up. Please go ahead.
Thanks. So I'll take off my chair hat and as a personal opinion, I agree with Donna to the extent that it is a piece of internet real estate and that there should be some floor set, personally speaking. I think we should take a closer look at the numbers. I think what I can try to do is divide it a third, a third, a third, meaning one third of it went to a contingency fund, one third went to technical evaluations, and I think one third was to compensate for all of the previous activities that ICANN had done for the number of years leading up to the launch of the program. I don't think 185 going forward would necessarily be that floor, because presumably we probably wouldn't need such a big contingency fund. Wouldn't think there would be as many costs ICANN would have in setting up the new program. So I think if we figure out what that amount realistically should be, from a personal perspective, I'm happy with some sort of floor.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. And we've had a few more comments in the chat before we continue on. I see that John Nevitt made the comment, unlike in the 2012 round, we need to indicate what happens to excess application fees. The 2012 application guidebook said what happened to auction proceeds, but not excess application fees. And Donna agreed with John. Michael Fleming also agreed with John. I wasn't even aware of the cost recovery until they talked about offsetting the fees. And Michael continued, so make it clear for cost recovery. And if nothing happens, it turns into a deposit, or like Ruben said, it comes back as a discount. Cheryl has noted, Jeff, that makes sense to me. Jeff continued on. I agree with Donna and John on that. I think we do ask that in the CC2 questions. And then John has noted, depends on how long we take. ICANN charges back for historical cost, $185,000 might not be enough. And then finally we have Rubens here, $185,000 is not small cash for some world regions. So even if organizations that don't qualify for applicant support and shouldn't, would be disenfranchised by such a large fee. I see there's multiple people typing, and Michael has just raised his hand. So go ahead, Michael.
Have we explored the option of having different costs for the different categories of PLDs? So say, for example, if you have a brand and considering the amount of check that goes, the necessary process and whatnot that goes into that for the evaluation, I'm sure costs could be considered to be somewhat different. Or are all TLDs marginally the same as far as costs per evaluation and what to expect?
Hi, it's Krista. In the last call, we kind of went down that road of being that we don't have any insight into the different costing methods for each application or each different type of application, that trying to get some insight into that going forward based on the different application types would be useful. And it ties into that new working group on determining what those application types would be, and then asking, I guess, ICANN to do some potential costing around that. And again, probably assuming that if something's, you know, within a certain ballpark, it's not worth having a different fees, but if they are very different, then a different cost structure for the different type of application might make sense. If that's helpful.
Thank you.
Jeff, I see you have your hand up. Go ahead.
And I put this in the chat, but I figured it's much easier to explain. So I think what we really need to do is, without focusing on what the exact figure should be, is really set out the policy principle, which is really cost recovery with a floor, recognizing this is a valuable piece of internet real estate, but also indicating things like we may not need such a large contingency fund. Then the other thing which this relates to is if there is, and it's a big if obviously, if there is an RSP approval program, then perhaps rather than registry operators during the application period funding the evaluation of the back-end RSP, we could have RSPs fund their own approval process so that the front-end registries don't have to pay for the evaluation of a third party. So that may also lower the cost recovery.
Yes, I don't agree with that completely and saying that we shouldn't be looking at the specific costs. I mean, as Donna specifically stated, we need to keep the bar raised at some point. So keeping it in some ballpark area is rather important. And more to the point, I think personally I'd like to explore a bit more what cost recovery is supposed to include. I mean, what was that amount supposed to be used for? And if it wasn't used, then why wasn't it used? Because I'm not 100% sure what all that was originally supposed to be, well, used for. Sorry to repeat myself. But that's my 2 cents.
Thank you, Michael. Jeff, I see you had your hand back up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, just to respond to Michael. So when I said we don't need to look at costs, I don't think I said that. What I said is we shouldn't be focusing on 185 versus 180 versus 90. I think the way that I can develop the costs, first of all, was based on educated guessing and good guessing, based on I think they thought potentially 500 applications. So they obviously underestimated the number of applications, as most of the community did. And, you know, they may have overestimated some evaluation costs or where they could have gotten some efficiencies from scale. So I think that there's better information now from within ICANN of how much the evaluations cost, let's say, per application, and how that went down if there were multiple applications by the same registry operator and the same registry service provider. So what I'm saying is we should set out the policy concept that it should be cost recovery, and they should base that on the information from this past round, but also recognizing that if that figure drops lower than what the community expects, though I don't know how to measure that, if it drops to such a low point, then there should be a floor in place to recognize, as Donna said, that this is a piece of internet real estate. So I don't want us to take 185,000 as being kind of the figure that we're trying to measure against, since that was just a guess. And ICANN had to make a guess in order to, you know, run the program. But it's better information now. But I think we let ICANN do what it has the experience and expertise to do, which is to figure out a real cost-based estimate based on what's already been done and take that figure and make sure it encompasses the policy that this is a piece of internet real estate.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. That was very helpful. Michael, I think you have a response that you would like to say, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I'll be very brief. Okay, Jeff, I agree. I do agree with that. I'm not saying an exact cost, but I do think that some range in mind, there should be some range in mind when looking at the policy. I think what would be a really good idea is ask ICANN specifically that based upon the current, looking not, not without a new, not giving a new policy in mind, but looking at the current, what happened in the past, if we were to carry out a second round, for example, or a subsequent procedure, what, depending on the range or depending on the amount of TLDs that apply, what would be the difference between, for example, 500 applicants applied, 1,000 applicants applied, 1,500, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, et cetera, and see if we can't figure out if that number differs distinctively based on how many applicants applies versus what we need to keep in mind for the cost. Because I don't think the policy is going to change too much in the fact that cost recovery needs to be in place, but at the same time, though, I think that everyone is concerned about the amount while making sure that it is a very important piece of internet real estate and wanting to keep that cost set at some range that it doesn't make it too cheap for everybody to just start filing an application. see that with a lot of trademarks all the time. But anyways, that's I'm not even going to go into that discussion, but that's my follow-up. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Michael. And I see we've had some good discussions going on still in the chat. Justine Chu noted, I agree with Jeff's approach. Also, can some portion of the excess application fee in 2012 be designated as a financial support for the next round of applicants, which fall under Ruben's group of some world region based on some set of criteria, of course. And then John Nevitt said, so maybe the fee should not be cost recovery. It should be a fixed amount, but any excess amounts collected should go to Y. And then he continued on, I definitely don't agree that excess fees of one round should go to the next. Might be okay for auction proceeds, but not for application fees. And then Donna noted at Cheryl, perhaps the applicant support aspect should expand to cover Ruben's point. And then John followed up at Donna, and that would be a good use of auction proceeds. And Ruben's noted, Justine, I'm not advocating for lesser fees for all organizations from underserved regions. Even in underserved, there are some large pockets, but a large pocket in those regions means one thing, in others, another. And then Trang noted, there's some program costs in the fiscal year 2017, I can budget here on page 32, the link provided. Page 33 of that budget has a breakdown of eval costs per eval panel. And then Justine noted at Ruben's, sure, I don't mean in the blanket, any such an applicant ought to be deserving based on some set of criteria. Rubens then noted deserving applicants are of concern for applicant support, but by establishing a fee that is not based on cost recovery, but from economic power of usual organizations in large markets, this automatically cuts in a different level for underserved regions. And then Michael asked, does anyone want to contribute to applicant support? Do our fees make up for applicant support? Rubens replied, and there is the warning that's usually repeated, that defining fees per region leads to gaming by setting up shell corporations in those regions. And Michael has said, I think that goes back to the point that was made at the Hyderabad APAC space in regards to the subject, that if the applicant fees are too low for underserved regions, that undermines the actual cost of the variable fees they need to undertake to run a TLD. And then Train provided a link to the new GTLD program budget memo from 2010. So very active discussion, really good information being provided. Krista, do you have anything that you'd like to add at this point?
Thanks, Sarah. I don't really have anything to add, but I think it's something that we need to go into future or more discussions going forward. And I'm not really sure how best to proceed to go that route. So I guess we can take the comments from today and try to think further, but I guess the question is, do we want to suggest, or is there a sufficient basis to suggest that another working group perhaps be considered to address this, or do we need other information first, and or what's the best road forward?
Jeff, do you have any suggestions here? Go ahead, Jeff.
I mean, I think for now we have enough to ask some questions in CC2. So I think we should get community feedback on these subjects. And I think once we get that community feedback, again, I really think that our job is to come up with a policy position, not necessarily determine what the amount is. So we should determine whether it's fixed or variable from a policy perspective. We should determine from a policy perspective what type of formula should be used to calculate those the costs. And then we should, as a policy perspective, make a recommendation on how surpluses should be allocated, recognizing the nonprofit nature of ICANN. And we do have to deal with the opposite side of what if there's a shortfall. How do we deal with those? So, I think that we should be focusing more on the policy issues as opposed to coming up with the exact amount. And I think if you look at most of the comments that were made here, I do think that we do have certain principles that we can extract even from this call, even if we don't have some sort of final kind of recommendation. I do think that there certainly seems to be a recognition that, you know, it's important that ICANN recover all of its costs at a minimum. It also seems to be coming out of discussions here that it should also be recognized that this is a valuable piece of interstate internet real estate, and that needs to be recognized. And I think that if you go through the notes, there's some other concepts, I think, that we can pull out. I think we can get, just to finish up, I think we could get too lost in the weeds if we try to break it down any further than that. Even from looking at the slides that Trang has pointed out, it's just, we can't base it per application, as Trang says, because some were withdrawn after initial evaluation, some had to be reevaluated. But ICANN should still be able to figure out an average cost per application. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. That's very helpful. And thank you, everyone, for the great conversation on this evening. It's been some very good information that we are, as Krista has noted in the chat, we will combine and come up with high-level questions for consideration at the next call. So thank you all for your input on this. So I guess we will move on then if there are no further comments on this topic for our next slide. Okay. So, Krista, did you want to speak to this slide here on application queuing?
Sure. It's Krista for the record. So on the last call, we discussed application queuing, and there were some questions that came up on IDN prioritization and whether or not it worked. So I just did some quick analysis on the numbers and what it actually looked like. So there's two types of charts here. One is the number of days it took the IDNs with a priority number less than, say, 120 to the date where they signed the ICANN agreement, and the second one is the number of days to delegation. And I think somehow it lost some of my numbers on the side of that chart where I'm going to copy and paste it. But what you'll see here is that some of them were very quick to come out of the gate and others not so much. So, for example, the length of time or, you know, the number of agreements that were signed between 61 and 120 days was 11 applicants. And some of them didn't participate, but funny enough, I think there's three applications that didn't participate in the draw, but yet still signed within the 481 to 540-day category, and one within the 601 to 700-day category. So it's kind of all over the map, and you would think that there might have been some kind of trend there, but there isn't. Similarly, the same with delegation. And if you go, I'll just show you not to mess anyone's eyes, but here's just a kind of a quick look at what you can actually see from the data. So there's clearly no correlation between the priority number and when they launched and the number of days that they all took. The average is still quite high. And unfortunately, I didn't have enough data to go and compare it to the, let's say, the typical non-IDN application. So kind of gives us a little bit of insight into the IDNs, but doesn't really give us enough information to say it really paid off to have the IDN prioritization program, although it did for some. So that's kind of the quick overview from the last call.
Okay, great. Thank you, Krista. Does anyone have any questions regarding this information? Michael, I see your hand is raised. Please go ahead.
Application period. Well, not the end of that, but was the IDN prioritization, was that a volunteer or was that something that was immediately, automatically assigned to IDNs?
Hi, it's Krista. No, they had to choose whether or not they wanted to be in the prioritization draw.
Trang, I see you have your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to provide information relating to the IDN prioritization. Those IDN applications that wish to purchase a ticket were given the priority to purchase the tickets, so they were had the opportunity to be among the first to 100 and something, I think, at that point in time, IDN applications to be evaluated. Those that did not wish to purchase a prioritization ticket drew a number after all of the non-IDN drew their tickets. So those IDNs that purchased a ticket got to draw a prioritization number first, and then those that did not purchase a ticket got to draw a prioritization number after the non-IDN that purchased the ticket. I hope that makes sense. Thanks.
Sorry, it's Krista.
Great.
Can
yes.
I just add one thing, Sarah? Sorry, Sarah, can I interrupt just for a quick sec? Sorry, I see your yes. Just tying it back to the call from last time, the application subject was to deliberate on the different application processing methodologies and whether first-come, first-served guidance remains relevant or not, and whether another mechanism is more appropriate. So we agreed on the lottery system, but then we also wanted to consider the IDNs and how we would address that potentially in future application rounds or whatever it might be, and whether first-come, first-served was still appropriate. So just, take a step back. I kind of jumped into the details without laying the land out. So, you know, I'm cognizant of time here, but I guess the question is really whether we think the application queuing and having IDNs still having priority first is the question or up for discussion? Sorry, Michael, I see you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Repeat my question earlier. But so IDNs were given IDNs who wanted to go first before other IDNs were given top priority, and then after that, IDNs had priority over ASCII TLDs, correct? I'm looking at my own data, and I see that TLDs 17 given the priority number 1767 through 1774 are also IDNs, but these appear to be mainly brands. I'm assuming, of course, I don't have the specific data at this time, but the question for me comes out that whether or not these TLDs are, is a
Hi, Michael. I can't hear you. Maybe while we wait for Michael to come back, Donna, would you like to go ahead, please?
Thanks, Krista. Donna Austin. I think this is possibly to the question Michael was going to ask, but does anybody remember the rationale for why IDNs would be considered ahead of ASCII? I don't know that that was a policy decision. I think that was an implementation decision made by FADI, but I could be wrong, because I think if we understand why that was done, we might be in a better position to answer the question of whether we think we should do a repeat for next time. Thanks.
That's my question. Thank you.
This is Jeff. From my recollection, and I have Kurt on here as well, it was a, as Kurt just said, to promote IDNs and diversity. It was a top-down decision made by FADI in response to some comments and questions as to why we were running the program. If you remember, there was a lot of last-minute lobbying against the program even launching from organizations like the ANA, so the National Advertisers, and a bunch of others. And I think it was kind of a political give from the ICANN CEO to the community. So it was definitely not a policy position. And as John said, we kind of all went along with it to get process moving, especially because we realized there weren't that many IDN applications. But we need to decide from a policy perspective whether we should endorse or not endorse that, and also send a message that this should not be a decision made by the ICANN CEO or the ICANN board without community approval.
Thank you, Jeff. Cheryl, I see you have your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Cheryl, for the record. Just wanted to remind everybody who probably didn't bother at any stage reading any ALAC advice, and I do mean their capital A advice to the board, as well as many of the submissions and the various public comments to all of the various iterations of the applicant guidebook, that the ALAC and the at-large community had always made a strong point that their support for new GTLDs, in some cases quite limited support, as opposed to in some other cases outright hesitation for support, was universally back to, I think, 2000 and certainly 2008, 2009, when I was writing them, on behalf of the community as opposed to myself, very much contingent on an active support of internationalized domain names. So, yeah, I'm not arguing where it was in policy or not. I'm certainly not arguing about top-down or bottom-up.
but I am suggesting that at least a part of the ICANN community had constantly said a special case should be made for IDN. So it wasn't actually a, you know, bolt of blue without any foundation from any part of community. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Cheryl. I see we've had some discussion in the chat here. Let me see if I can scroll up without my chat jumping everywhere. Krista, is there anything that you would like to add? Michael Fleming, I hand it up. Okay, please go ahead.
Just going to say that I agree with giving priority to IDNs as long as they want it. As they wanted, of course, but in some cases, for those TLDs that have to launch first, that makes it complicated if they're not prepared. So give them priority if they want it, but at the same time, don't force it upon them. And I would agree with Jeff and on his note that he said before, Cheryl, and yes.
Thank you, Michael.
Hi, it's Krista. Maybe we should ask the question of whether we think there should be priority to IDNs, and that would be one of our recommendations. Obviously, because they, you know, we're not going to force it on them, but because they would like it. Perhaps that's one way to go forward. Up to you, though, Sarah.
That's a great idea, Krista. Yes, we can definitely add that as one of our questions. Okay, I know we're starting to get close to the top of the hour. So in the interest of time, I don't want to get to our discussion on the application guidebook today, but let's go ahead and scroll down here. I know during our last call, and Krista can speak to this if she prefers, we had asked staff to come up with some recommendations. They are working on those, and we will go over that during our next call. Krista, do you have anything to add on this topic here, on the systems and communications outside of the staff recommendations?
Hi, it's Krista for the record. No, I think given the time, maybe we'll wait to have those recommendations back, and then we'll do that via email. And then even if we can maybe just hit the applicant guidebook just on that one order, you know, slide, it would be helpful just to set the surroundings for the next call. Do you want me to do that, or do you want to do it?
You can go ahead and do it. That'd be great.
Okay. So the applicant guidebook, just quickly, it's the goal is whether or not it is the right implementation of the GNSO recommendations, and if so, how can it be improved to ensure that it meets the needs of the multiple audiences, and includes the monitoring of the policy implementation, the preliminary issue report on new GPLD subsequent procedures. So quickly, the task is to consider the guidance, particularly around the structure of the AGB, for consideration in developing through the next AGB the modifications, and would presumably remain an iterative community-inclusive process. So for consideration is, would partitioning the AGB in distinct audience-driven sections improve its readability and understanding of rules? Secondly, should it be made more process-driven, i.e. providing more step-by-step instructions? And or is it potentially the wrong vehicle for implementation of the policy entirely? And if so, what would be an alternative? So I know we only have a few minutes left here, but just a couple questions maybe we can open up for discussion is, do we think the AGB is the right methodology? And I know that seems like a pretty straightforward question because we don't really have any alternatives, but if anyone has any ideas or suggestions, please raise your hand or speak out now. Jeff, please go ahead.
This is Jeff. I think that one of the points, and I remember when this question came up with the, in the issues or discussion group, I think it should be a very comprehensive applicant guidebook, but I think what we should endeavor, ICANN should endeavor to put together different types of guidebooks or for depending on the role that that party plays. So it should, so you should have this one comprehensive one. And for those that don't need all the technical information, you could have another set. Or, you know, so I think that this is probably still the right way to go. Certainly improvements could be made, but I don't think a complete revamping is something we should be entertaining at this point.
Anyone else have any comments? Alan, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I tend to agree with Jeff. I'm sure it could be done differently, but unless we can identify specific failures that we have to adjust in the next go-around, then the benefits of redoing it from scratch with all the inherent potentials for problems in that format, I just don't see it.
Great, thank you. I realize that we are up to our 60 minutes, and unfortunately we didn't get to a bunch of our slides on the CCP questions. So I guess we would both encourage everyone to go and to review the questions and adjust, and we will also take in some of the ideas that were brought up in today's call and included in there. And then I guess the next work track call is scheduled for Tuesday, February 28th at 2000 UTC. And thank you, everyone, for their participation, and have a great day or a great evening. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.